Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Tax laws don't just write themselves, you know, how Congress dots the legislative I's and crosses the T's. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kyle Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 24th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There comes a time in the life of all policy stories when you got to get down to the nitty gritty, the nuts and bolts, the process of how whatever is going to get done is going to get done. Today for us is that day. While all eyes, most anyway, were on the lunch that President Trump had with Senate Republicans this afternoon and on that remarkable speech from the soon-to-be ex-GOP Senator from Arizona, Jeff Flake, just afterward, those in the economic know were hanging around the tax bill writing House Committee on Ways and Means. The House is expected to let the rest of us see its tax plan next week. But until then, there is legislating writing being done. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour gives us some idea of what is going to go into writing this most high-profile of tax bills.
Somewhere on Capitol Hill, Republican lawmakers on the House Ways and Means Committee are hammering out a tax plan. And if they aren't sleep-deprived now, they're going to be.
As they get closer, they will be meeting late into the night.
Ken Keyes directs the Federal Policy Group. He was chief Republican tax counsel for the Ways and Means Committee when Congress actually reformed taxes in 1986.
I can remember conferences where we were there at 4 a.m. with somebody from the Treasury Department behind me, dead asleep, snoring.
The basic structure of any tax plan is hashed out in meetings, long meetings, lots of them, in private. The objective for the plan right now is pretty simple.
Raising revenue to get all the goodies.
Jeff Birnbaum is co-author of Showdown at Gucci Gulch, which chronicled tax reform in the 80s. Goodies, meaning lower tax rates for some.
What individuals and industries have to pay more in order to get those benefits?
And while lawmakers are crunching and recrunching numbers, keeping tabs on the optics of what they're doing and otherwise trying to wear each other down, they're also contending with something that they didn't have to back in, well, ever. Presidential tweets. Senator Byron Dorgan was on the House Ways and Means Committee during the 86 tax reform.
The president is sending out tweets from the White House saying, here's what I support, and it may well be completely the opposite of what he supported the day before or the week before.
That, he says, makes lawmakers' jobs even tougher, but not impossible. At the end of the day, the Ways and Means Committee will write the bill it wants to write. Lobbyists, the Senate, and the president will all get their turn. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Also at that lunch with the president, by the way, a lot of GOP senators are said to have expressed a preference for Stanford economist John Taylor to be the next Fed chair, replacing Janet Yellen. That sent rates on the 10-year Treasury note, that is, its interest rate, to five-month highs, because along with John Taylor would come his eponymous Taylor rule, which would put the Fed's benchmark interest rate a not small amount higher than it is today. The 10-year coming in the numbers, as it always comes. All right, moving on. You know how so much in retail right now is about repurposing old or not really as profitable as they should be retail spaces? Well, here's one. The country's oldest luxury retailer, Lord & Taylor, announced today it is selling its iconic Manhattan headquarters for $850 million. After Christmas next year, the space is going to become the headquarters for WeWork, a seven-year-old office space startup you might have heard of by now. It's valued at $20 billion, makes it the fourth most valuable privately held U.S. startup behind Airbnb, Uber, and SpaceX. Pretty good company. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank explains that one.
WeWork got its start in 2010, taking advantage of cheap rents to lease office space, redesign interiors, and sublease them as co-working spaces. The company is now the nation's largest leaser of new office space. Ross Moore is with Cressa Commercial Real Estate Services.
They're a classic disruptor. Commercial real estate is pretty staid and some would say boring, but co-working and WeWork in particular is making everybody consider that maybe things are changing in the leasing world.
WeWork has become the Uber of office space, says Melissa Marsh at commercial real estate firm Savills Studley. It's transformed the leasing business.
From big, slow transactions for 100,000 square feet for 20 years to now a 20-square-foot product that you can get for an hour.
The company has sold more than 150,000 memberships that allow users to work out of its 170 locations. Workforce culture is changing. 66% of employers now allow staff to work remotely. That's doubled over the past decade. Ross Moore says this business model is working, but what if the economy slows?
With co-working, if your business turns down, you just give 1 month's notice and you're gone. And there could be a lot of empty space just sitting there. Of course, you know, WeWork is still on the hook to pay rent.
WeWork isn't slowing down, but expanding into a full-on millennial lifestyle brand. This month, it opened its first gym and purchased a popular coding academy. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, more records. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Much as history sometimes seems to repeat itself, so too does business. The proposals to be Amazon's second headquarters city are all now sitting on Jeff Bezos' desk, among them an offering from Dallas, Texas. But this is not the city's first time playing in the corporate headquarters big league. 16 years ago, North Texas almost won the headquarters of another Seattle-based giant contemplating a move, Boeing. And while history does record that Chicago won that one, the economic story didn't end there. From KERA in Dallas, Lauren Silverman explains that that defeat is part of the reason Dallas is in the running for Amazon today.
Back in 2001, a Texan was in the White House. Dallas native Erykah Badu was on the radio. And billionaire Mark Cuban had recently bought the Mavericks. You could say things were looking up, but downtown Dallas, it was dead. Some joked the sidewalks rolled up at 5 p.m.
Everybody that worked down here, which happens to be the largest workforce in North Texas, they come to work, get out of their car, go to their office, and come back to their car and go home.
John Crawford is CEO of the economic development group Downtown Dallas, Inc. He says there were only a few hundred people living downtown. Everyone had fled to the suburbs. So when Seattle-based behemoth Boeing announced it was looking to move its headquarters and considering the Dallas area, everyone scrambled to come up with a desirable proposal, one that focused on amenities besides downtown. Chris Wallace was CEO of the Greater Irving Las Colinas Chamber of Commerce at the time.
So our pitch was, you know, the ready skilled workforce, great transportation systems, easy access, housing opportunities. We thought we had a very good package.
He says even sports heroes got in on selling North Texas. In the competition to land the world's largest aerospace company, Dallas made it to the final three. The other cities were Chicago and Denver. Valletta Forsyth-Lill, who was on city council at the time, says folks in Dallas were betting tax incentives and a business-friendly environment could land the deal. She worried that wouldn't be enough.
And I think a very unfortunate mistake that we made, I can remember showing up at a reception for Boeing in a presentation, and it was done in a high-end suburban hotel. As nice as that hotel is, really gives you no sense of being any place other than a suburb, which can look like other suburbs in America.
Boeing wanted more. Chicago, with its lively art scene, took the gold. Lil says the rejection was a major ego blow.
What it felt like was Boeing felt that we were not a major American city. And I think that was the hurt.
In the early 2000s, people like Lil had a vision for what Dallas could become. Big plans to renovate historic buildings for residential use, to build a world-class theater, opera house, and sculpture garden. But you can't sell vision, Lil says. You have to sell reality. So private donors stepped up. Wealthy individuals gave tens of millions of dollars to help bring the Dallas Arts District to life.
You're in the largest urban arts district, and it has substantially evolved.
Lil is sitting downtown at a cafe next to, yes, an opera house and a theater. From here, you can see the district's evolution. Kids running through green grass, planes overhead, and a five-acre park down the street. In just a few blocks, there's a collection of five cultural facilities, all of them done by Pritzker Prize-winning architects. Lil says some of these additions were a reaction to Boeing's rejection.
Boeing is in the back of people's mind. It was always a little nagging conscience piece. What do you, as Dallas, need to do to be a better city?
Lil says there's still a ways to go. But now, the sidewalks don't roll up at 5 o'clock, and Dallas is in a much better position to woo Amazon. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
Bill O'Reilly, celebrity chef John Besh in New Orleans, Hollywood director James Toback, and of course, Harvey Weinstein. Millions paid in settlements and non-disclosure agreements, dozens and dozens of women saying those four men harassed and or assaulted them. It's an issue that's become especially focused on Hollywood and the entertainment industry, a subject Janice Min knows well. She used to be the editor and is now a part owner of The Hollywood Reporter. Janice, it's good to have you on.
Nice to be here.
When you were running The Hollywood Reporter, you have said there were inklings of Harvey Weinstein. You went after this story. Why were you unable to get it, do you think?
There are a lot of answers to that, but really the most basic one is nobody would go on the record. But even before we couldn't get people to go on the record, finding people at all, I felt like at times we were chasing ghosts. You knew about this. You heard about this. Lots of smoke, but we could never locate the fire. It was probably one of the most maddening reporting exercises we did my entire time I was there, and it drove us crazy.
I want to ask you about the culture of Hollywood in a minute, but there's a smaller set of that I think I need to touch on. None of this happened in a vacuum, right? There were agents who were sending young women to interviews with Harvey Weinstein. There were assistants who were facilitating.
Yep.
There was a network of enablers in Hollywood that helped this happen.
Yes. I mean, I don't want to be too hyperbolic here, but you know, I'm hearing also from people in town a lot of discomfort with the cover-up, the willful blind eye that was turned to all of this, that agents on the letterhead of their agencies, and let's remember Harvey Weinstein and his companies have been represented by CAA for a very long time, no longer right now, obviously, but that letterhead would go out to actresses saying, meet Harvey Weinstein, go to room, you know, 412 at the Peninsula, and, you know, you will have a one-on-one private meeting with him. If all these actresses, many of whom are, let's say, CAA clients or WME clients or any of these other agencies, had told their agents that after the time of their assault, which I believe many of them now say they did tell people privately, it's stunning to think that then you are basically sending woman after woman after woman into the lion's den.
What do you make of the men now who are coming out and saying, they're saying literally, I knew. Quentin Tarantino, again in the New York Times, talked to them for an hour and said, Mira Sorvino told me that this happened, and that was 20 years ago.
You know, it's amazing. I think nobody could really have ever imagined the scope of what was going on here and the sheer numbers. I think these men, and I think we've seen this in various places that we've traveled, just as individuals in our lives where someone, you know, says, oh, that person's kind of a, you know, shady character, or that person's kind of pervy, like, you know, and you might laugh about it, might make you uncomfortable, and it just sort of becomes the fabric of a place. And it's one of those things where I feel like Hollywood didn't want to know, for starters, but also that you are living with ugly furniture for so long, you just sort of accept it. And so, yes, we have the shock of the Harvey Weinstein allegations out now, but boy, I think there are so many more concentric circles that are going to implode as a result of this.
Do you think this is a transformational moment for this industry, which is by its very nature predatory, especially upon young women?
Oh, I mean, this whole town is built on you know, the abuse and exploitation of young women, right? And it's fear, right? Fear that you are going to be replaced. Fear you're not going to get a job. Fear that a producer, even a, you know, big, hairy, sweaty producer who wants you to give him a massage can ruin your career. I mean, that is the power dynamic here. I mean, I think if you ask women in town to raise your hand if you haven't been sexually harassed, you maybe could get two hands up, you know, up in the air. It's just, it's sort of this stunning awakening of the most open secret finally being spilled out into the world. Is it going to be a change? I don't know. I think there will be a lot more thoughtfulness around hiring, and that will make a big difference. Because how, you know, if you're powerless, you have to find a woman in power to be able to go talk to if you want to see any change. And I think we've seen time and again, whether it was at Fox News, at the Weinstein Company, you know, you do the right thing. You're a good corporate citizen. You go tell HR. And what does HR do? Nothing. And that's where women can get just stymied in the system, and you end up feeling like you're in the matrix and, you know, not living a real or ethical life.
Janice Min used to be the editor of The Hollywood Reporter. She is now a part owner of that publication. Janice, thanks very much.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up.
I didn't want to have to experience the feeling of not belonging in an institution that I was paying for.
An enrollment bump for historically black colleges and universities. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials was up 167 points today, 0.7%, closed at 23,441. The NASDAQ up 11, about 0.1%, 65.98. The S&P 500, 4 points to the good, also a 0.1%, 25.69. One sign things are turning around for the construction industry, heavy equipment maker Caterpillar posted strong earnings today. Sales up 27% in North America, 57% in Asia, boosted, of course, by China. Shares hammered up a tad shy of 5%. 3M, maker of Post-it notes and a whole bunch of other things, blew past analyst expectations. Overseas sales, very healthy. Thank you very much. Worked in its favor. Exchange rate-wise, also, those Post-it notes had dollar signs written all over them. Shares up 5.9% today. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note, as I said, thank you, John Taylor, and the Taylor Rule, up to 2.42%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I can quote all the headline economic numbers that I like, but the reality is, if people aren't feeling good about their own economic day-to-day, then the statistics don't really much matter, right? That's the working assumption behind our series. It's called My Economy. Today, a dispatch from Cleveland, Ohio.
My name is Ron Hill. I draw pictures. I'm a media designer, a graphic designer. Everything was always drawing. I wanted to be an illustrator, but, you know, I got out of art school and said, well, you have to get a job. You have to do commercial work, which was fun too. But after 10 years, I just wanted to do something more. I realized that it was my decision to work for who I wanted to work for. And so that made it easy to kind of go freelance, do that for 10 years. And then when I started teaching, I tried to teach that to my students. If you really want to do this, you will find a way to make it work if you do well at it. A friend of mine came to me and said, I want to do something different with the business I own, and I could use another designer. And if you're interested, let's talk about a partnership. And so that last day of school, that 13th year of teaching, was, okay, now I'm graduating. Now I'm going on to do something new. In the last month, two more full-time editorial cartoonists from very major newspapers have been laid off. A lot of the people are doing what I do. They're freelancing when they get laid off. It's been fun and profitable. It's been moving forward.
Take a second, if you can, to tell us about your economic reality. There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org/myeconomy. There are in the United States just over 100 historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs they're called. Most of them were founded in the South after the Civil War, when established schools basically refused to admit African Americans. We're in a time now in this country of renewed attention to race in this economy, about conversations about class and protest and free speech. And that might help explain why, after a bunch of rough years, enrollment is up at a lot of HBCUs. From the Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
On the 150-year-old campus of Morgan State University in Baltimore, the band warms up a crowd before a groundbreaking ceremony for a new $90 million student services building. President David Wilson welcomes the mayor and dozens of other dignitaries and alums.
You know, growth is essential to the vibrancy and to the relevancy of a modern university, and Morgan must never, ever cease to grow.
The historically black public university is growing. At a time when college enrollment overall is declining, applications to Morgan for this fall were up 20%, and the new freshman class of about 1,250 students is the largest in 5 years. Wilson credits a big investment in the admissions process. The college hired a new rep in the Midwest and another focused on recruiting more Latino students. A quarter of Morgan's students today do not identify as black. Like many colleges, it's also recruiting more international students.
And then we have invested equally in ensuring that the nation and prospective students know the value of our programs.
Programs like summer internships at Facebook and Google, and a new partnership that allows students to study in China. Morgan's growth is part of a larger trend among HBCUs. North Carolina A&T State just welcomed the largest class in its history. Virginia State University's enrollment is up nearly 50% over the last 2 years. Michael Lomax represents 37 private HBCUs as president of the United Negro College Fund. He says some of the growth is a recovery from a 5% dip after the Obama administration tightened lending standards for the federal Parent PLUS loan in 2011.
That issue has been resolved. New credit standards have been established, and it's easier for parents to borrow again.
Mary Beth Gassman researches historically black colleges as director of the Penn Center for Minority-Serving Institutions. While many HBCUs still struggle with heavy debt and low enrollment, she estimates more than half have seen growth in the past few years.
HBCUs are tuition-driven, so any kind of enrollment increase, as long as they're prepared for it, is going to put them in a better position.
Gassman says the current racial climate, with white supremacists recruiting on college campuses and the contentious debate over Confederate monuments, has prompted more students and their parents to consider HBCUs.
So I think it's a combination of what's going on in the country that's negative, but it's also some positive things about really making sure that people know the value of an education at HBCUs.
Morgan State freshman Natavia Williams grew up in Colorado Springs, Colorado, where she was often the only black student in class. She chose Morgan for its multimedia journalism program, but she says a racially motivated attack on her sister at a predominantly white university last fall also influenced her decision.
That was really shocking to me, and I knew that I didn't want to have to experience the feeling of not belonging in an institution that I was paying for.
First-year student Jocelyn Christian grew up in Baltimore, listening to the Morgan Band and choir.
They have a phenomenal music program, very rigorous. And on top of that, being that it's an HBCU, it was just another plus to the package deal.
The United Negro College Fund's Michael Lomax says when he went to college in the 1960s and 70s, many of his fellow African-American students felt they had to tolerate indignities for the greater goal of integration.
I think this new generation doesn't feel the same sense of obligation. And I think they just want to feel like this is their institution as much as it is anyone else's.
And while black students are working to make campuses all over the country more inclusive, a growing number are choosing colleges where they've always been welcome. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
We'll be right back.
This final note on the way out, today in which Target finally gets it, kinda. The retailer said this week it is going to pull back on the Christmas advertising at the front of its stores until later in the season this year. Customers say they are getting tired of what has come to be called Christmas creep, so the chain is going to take a pause on Christmas so that it can, and this is a quote from the spokesperson, really recognize Thanksgiving. Okay, that's great, but I'm obliged to point out here, it's not even Halloween yet, people. Every now and then I hear music on this program and I'm like, wait, what? Daisy Palacios for the win today. The Dow up 167 points, 0.7%. The NASDAQ up 11 points, about 0.1%. S&P 500 up 4, also 0.1%. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.